All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Grant C. Jaquick presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I am Judge Jaquith, and I'm joined in the courtroom at Albany Law School. Thank you for having us. By Chief Judge Allen to my right and Judge Toth to my left. We are convened today to consider arguments in the case of John Omar Williams, case number 24-2592 versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for our record.
My name is Rebecca Pierce, Your Honors, from National Veterans Legal Services Program. On behalf of Mr. Williams, with me at counsel table is Mr. Christopher Murray. Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Amanda Rackey, on behalf of the Secretary, and with me, Janelle Reed. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. When determining whether an issue is reasonably raised, context matters. Here, the question is whether the evidence of record reasonably raised entitlement to TDIU. Viewing the evidence in the context of unemployability, which requires consideration of the veteran's specific circumstances, the record shows that Mr. Williams experienced a stark decline in employment. He went from working as a substitute teacher to working as a lunchroom monitor for 3 hours a day, if at all. At the same time, Mr. Williams also experienced symptoms such as suicidal ideation, impaired insight, and an inability to establish and maintain effective relationships.
Ms. Pierce, I'm sorry to jump in at the beginning, but I have a sort of a stage setting question. And this is not meant to be critical, but at some point between the initial briefing and the supplemental briefing, the appellant's position changed a little bit on what is a really important issue for me because it tells me which road to go down. In the opening brief, it seemed to be that you were arguing that the board just didn't address entitlement to TDIU at all in any respect. And so you were asking the court to determine whether or not the board erred because it didn't consider TDIU.
Correct.
However, in your supplemental brief, and it seems like a small change, but you said that the board made, quote, an implicit determination that the disputed issue was not reasonably raised. And the reason that I want you to sort of firmly take a position on which one of those things you're doing is it matters. Because if the board made a determination, implicit or explicit, then we're reviewing something. We are reviewing the determination, which we would do by assessing clear error. If the board just didn't do anything at all, then we're doing something else, but we're not reviewing a determination because it, by definition, it hasn't been made. So is it your position that the board made an implicit determination about TDIU or not?
Under Bean, our position has changed slightly to your point, where when looking at all of the research that we were conducting to provide the supplemental memo, we decided that under Bean, the board's silence would constitute an implicit denial in this situation. So yes, we are. Our position is now that the board, by being entirely silent on the matter, implicitly denied that TDIU was reasonably raised.
So my next question then, okay, so you want us to go down sort of path number one, which I'm going to call the clear error review, okay, because we're now then under that view, if we determine that the board made an implicit determination, we're actually not in the world of what can the court do on its own right away. We're in the world of saying whether or not that implicit determination leaves us with a firm conviction that there's an error.
Correct.
Okay. So in a case called Hamill in the Federal Circuit, dealing with regional office determinations, the Federal Circuit determined that there couldn't be implicit denials.
Correct.
Under the AMA.
Yes.
How do you understand Hamill applies, if at all, to the board?
We do not believe that Hamill applies to the board because the Federal Circuit in Hamill specifically tailored the decision to the notice requirements placed on the regional office or the AOJ. In that situation, the regional office is governed by Section 5104, which has a different set of notice requirements than those placed on the board, which can be found in Section 7104. So in that situation, we read Hamill to not reach broader than the Federal Circuit tailored it to be in its decision.
Okay, thank you.
Why was the Veterans Council silent on the issue of TDIU before the board?
Well, Mr. Williams, while he was represented by a veteran service organization, this court has come to understand that in that situation, the veterans are still treated as pro se litigants. And while I do not have the best answer as to why this was not raised explicitly before the board, all I know is that it wasn't. And so now, when we were presented with the record, it is our duty as appellant's advocates to raise the issue when we see it. Because if we don't, then we run the risk of either abandoning the argument altogether or accepting the board's silence and then doing nothing with that.
And the regional office's rating decision didn't address TDIU either, did it?
Did not.
So if the board implicitly denied TDIU or denied that it was raised, right? Why wouldn't the board have a plausible reason for doing so on this evidence? In other words, you know, for example, you point to a part of the hearing transcript where I suppose you could read it one of two ways. You could read it to say, I couldn't get a job with an art degree, right? Moaning something that goes back probably centuries with people not being able to do much with an art degree. No offense to those art degree people out there. But you could also read it otherwise. And if you can read it one way or the other, why isn't the board's implicit determination at least plausibly based in the evidence?
If I may, Your Honor, the point that you just said about there are two different ways to read the sentence is exactly the issue, in that when there are multiple ways that you could read this, then that means that under Robinson, there is in at least one conceivable interpretation, any evidence that could support the theory of entitlement. And therefore, the board, by being entirely silent, we don't know exactly why the board did it what it did. And that's
and this is why my first question for me, mm-hmm. just speaking for myself, not my fellow panel members, is so important, because once we are in the world of you saying that the appellant's position is that there was an implicit determination, then what I have to do is put on my glasses that say I'm looking to see whether I have a definite and firm conviction that there was an error. And if you're looking at it that way and you have a piece of evidence, we'll just stick with the evidence I just read, and it can be read one way or the other, then it's difficult for me to have a definite and firm conviction that an error has been made, because we're starting with the point that there was an implicit determination. it would be a different place if we were starting from there wasn't an implicit determination.
Correct. However, even in the world where this was implicitly denied, the board's silence matters because at the very least, the board did not provide an adequate statement or reason of reasons and bases for its determination. So in that situation, we can't say with certainty that the board had a plausible basis because we don't know why the board made the decision it did. This decision is silent. There was no discussion or interaction with this evidence in this context. So at the very least, you have a Kaluza problem or a Section 7104 problem, a Gilbert problem. Either way, we have no answer as to why the board did what it did.
So, I mean, there's a circularity problem, obviously. I think the Federal Circuit kind of mentioned this. Is my mic on?
I can hear you.
The Federal Circuit mentioned this a couple weeks ago
at an argument, which is, you know, whatever the issue is, whether the board failed to address a reasonably raised issue, this is going to come up all the time, right? Which is, we have to review something. We have to make it an assessment of administrative error. How do we do so if a person could just say, well, this issue is raised? There's never going to be findings by definition that we can review. So how do we go about the process of engaging in judicial review of this?
If the board makes an explicit determination that something is not reasonably raised, then presumably they would follow that determination up with an analysis, and you would have a clear answer as to why they determined the issue wasn't reasonably raised. Maybe the board did make a finding of fact that this statement does in fact relate to the art degree, and they found that that art degree was the cause.
Maybe we can kind of back out a bit and kind of like look at the problem from a different angle, which is, I mean, it strikes me that there's sort of three situations in which maybe the board's failure to address something, or which we have to address something maybe that the board didn't. So Tadlock dealt with the prejudicial error. So obviously there's an error in a board finding. So, you know, administrative error has been found. And then the question is, did it affect the outcome? Is it open to debate, et cetera, so that we can assess prejudice. Another situation might be where there's a finding, you know, a denial of service connection, assignment of a rating, something. And the veteran's challenging that finding maybe because it failed to consider some evidence that might be relevant, right? That's normally a reasons and bases challenge. And the question would be about the materiality or relevance of whatever piece of evidence. So we have boxes, we have lanes for those. This strikes me as we're kind of in uncharted territory, which is, you know, there's a circular problem, which is a person could just say, well, okay, this issue was recently raised. How do we go about reviewing that?
In that situation, you are looking to see, you are reviewing the entire evidentiary record as it was before the board. And then you are in that.
But sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, Stinson says, it says the Veterans Court has no statutory authority to weigh evidence in the first instance. And yet this is the absence of a finding requires us to weigh evidence in the first instance. I mean, there's two different ways maybe to read Stinson. I mean, one would be in a more literal sense, which is whether we even have the statutory authority to assess administrative error in cases like this, that this whole line of assessing whether the board erred by failing to address a reasonably raised issue might be questionable. The other line would be to read it more as a standard by which the Federal Circuit just happens to review our findings. If we make a determination and someone wants to challenge it, if they find it open to debate, they'll reverse us. But I don't see how the open to debate, like how does this factor into how we review the board?
If I could take your earlier point first, in assessing whether an issue is reasonably raised or even assessing if the board erred in its silence or in its implicit determination, that does not necessarily require a weighing of evidence. Under Robinson, the question is if there is any evidence that could support the theory or issue in question, then the issue is reasonably raised. That is a very low bar. And
it doesn't matter how high a standard of review is or how low. There's going to be a threshold around which that becomes open to debate, right? I mean, you can have very generous pleading standards where, you know, 12b6, where the evidence could be viewed in different ways. You could have very strict ones, habeas, where it, so the evidence, this open debate is going to coalesce inevitably around some threshold. The question is, how do we resolve that?
It's our position that even despite the open to debate standard, this court can absolutely still determine whether an issue is reasonably raised in the first instance. However, if the court is not convinced and the court determines that an issue, the question of whether something is reasonably raised is primarily factual and therefore you cannot resolve it without resolving a matter open to debate, yeah, then the other alternative.
Lynch and, again, sorry to interrupt, but Lynch and Robinson says, hey, the whether an issue is reasonably raised is a quintessentially factual determination. And the Federal Circuit says we cannot review evidence in the first instance. And it, for this class of cases, there's no finding. So how do we get around that? I mean, we could give an automatic remand and then just not without a finding of administrative error, right? I mean, would that solve the problem?
No, the way you can get around that particular issue is, again, focusing on the evidence's existence, which is where I was getting to the point where it does not, the nature of the inquiry does not require weighing of evidence or assigning of probative value or finding of facts. It merely requires a facial inquiry into the record and a determination that this evidence exists and that a board adjudicator could view it in this light.
We're asking you a lot of questions, and I'm sure that presiding judge will give you some extra time, but in the context of a psychiatric disorder, rating of a psychiatric disorder in particular, which is what we have here, almost by definition, there will be evidence about employment and employability, because any rating from 30% higher, by definition, takes into account occupational impairment. So your standard, right, which is some evidence in the record, I think is sort of what you said, right, would by definition be met in every single case involving the rating of a psychiatric disorder, right?
Not necessarily. So
why, when you answer this, right, tell me then why it wouldn't be the weighing of evidence in a psychiatric case, because there would have to be some evidence of occupational impairment if the person has anything other than basically a 0 or 10% rating, right? And so at that point in time, there would be some evidence going to unemployability in the record. And once that evidence exists, wouldn't we be weighing evidence? So we'd have to have some other way to say what it is that we're properly doing.
No, Your Honor. So let's take Mr. Williams' case here. What we are pointing to is, yes, he is at the 70% rating, which contemplates occupational impairment. The board found as fact that Mr. Williams experiences occupational impairment with deficiencies in most areas. However, we also have evidence of, as I mentioned earlier, suicidal ideation, fair to poor insight, as well as an inability to establish and maintain effective relationships. At the same time, we also have evidence of a decline in Mr. Williams' employment, meaning at the same time that the severity and impact of his mental health symptoms increased, his employment then decreased. When you look at the entire evidentiary record, all, again, to repeat my earlier point, all you're looking at is, okay, this evidence exists, and a board adjudicator could determine that there is some connection there.
Wouldn't that be, I'm repeating myself, and so maybe it's just that we're going past each other, but wouldn't that be true in every case? Because you're not arguing that he's entitled to 100% scheduler rating.
No.
Right, okay. So by definition, if you're 70% impaired, you've got a lot of evidence to support the fact that you're severely limited in your ability, your occupational abilities. And so by definition, what would we do? Would we discount the evidence that the board used to assign a 70% rating and say, is there something more
No, you would look at that evidence because when you're looking at whether or not entitlement to TDIU was reasonably raised, you are taking in all of the factors that TDIU requires be considered: occupational history, educational history, the extent and the impact of the service-connected disabilities, and then on the face of the record, and taking into all of those considerations. And to your point, if the board is faced with a veteran that has a 70% rating for mental health and there is also evidence of employment struggles, then yes, the board should automatically, the warning bells should go off and they should look at this.
So you use the word automatically. I mean, wouldn't that be the effect? Because one of us is going to have to sit down and write something, like actually write words that then other judges are going to follow in other cases. And it seems to me it's very difficult to write anything that wouldn't be what, like you just said, which is always. It seems to me that the notion in a psychiatric case, at least, is that by definition, when the person is rated, say at 70%, the board must always discuss TDIU because by definition, there is evidence that raises the issue in the record, and we can't weigh that evidence in the first instance.
The 70% rating alone is not enough to raise TDIU, specifically because it contemplates occupational impairment, but if there is evidence that the veteran is gainfully employed, then that would not render an automatic consideration.
Not an automatic rating, but isn't that what you're arguing, is that it automatically constitutes reasonably raised?
We are arguing that when there is evidence of occupational impairment or other evidence that shows there could be an association between the service-connected condition, in this case mental health, and the employment struggles, meaning that on the face of the record there is evidence of either unemployment outright or at least, you know, marginal employment, then in that situation it would trigger an inquiry. And this isn't uncommon because we know that TDIU is not a separate claim outright. We know that TDIU is part and parcel with an increased rating. So in that situation, the board is already put on notice when it gets an increased rating claim under Rice. TDIU is inherently connected to the increased rating. So when the board is already put on notice that it should be at least mindful of TDIU because it's being faced with an increased rating, and then you also have a level of impairment that does contemplate occupational deficiencies, and then you also have evidence of – I see my time is up. May I
– Yes, you can have 5 more minutes.
Thank you. And then you also add the evidence of employment struggles. When you take all of those things together in the larger context, as well as the veteran's individual circumstances, that's what triggers the board to be looking and determining whether entitlement to TDIU is reasonable.
So what happens here where neither the board nor the regional office address the matter?
Here, we are asking the court to find that entitlement to TDIU was reasonably raised and that the board erred in not addressing the issue on the merits. So here, we are asking the court to look at all of the evidence that we have discussed, and particularly, we're asking the court to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the veteran, with the background of the legal context, and then determine that there is at least some evidence, meaning that someone at the board should address this on the merits, regardless.
Where does your scintilla of evidence as a measure of whether an issue's been reasonably raised by the record, where does that come in? What's the justification for that?
If I may clarify, Your Honor, are you asking what evidence we're pointing to, or are you just asking?
No, where you came up with the standard that a scintilla of evidence is enough to constitute reasonably raising an issue?
That came from our review of the case law in terms of the reasonably raised. So the specific language from Robinson is that where there is no evidentiary support, that is absolutist. And so then we took that and we reversed it and we put it on its head, meaning the opposite of no evidence is any evidence. And so if there is any evidence, no matter how slight, then that is enough to meet the low threshold.
But then I come back, what is the, and maybe the answer is there isn't, right? That's acceptable. But in a psychiatric case, there will by definition always be evidence going to occupational impairment, right? Because it's not just that occupational impairment is in the background, right, which would be for the knee disability as well, but the rating criteria for a mental disorder by definition includes occupational impairment. So well, how could you draw a line that says that there would ever be a case where there wouldn't be some evidence going to occupational impairment? Maybe the answer is, in the context of a psychiatric disability, the board must always discuss it because of the very nature of the rating criteria. That's okay. But I can't think of a situation that would fall on the other side of the line where there would be, quote, no evidence of occupational impairment.
I think a situation where there would be no evidence, again, because we're talking about TDIU, which means that there has to be some form of unemployability, and meaning that they're either the veteranizer has to be unemployed or not be able to you know, sustain or obtain substantially gainful employment. So if there is evidence that the veteran is happily working at a full-time job and has absolutely no issues keeping that job and has all of the reports that all of his coworkers
are... How is that not weighing evidence? I mean, you know, evidence can be obvious. It can be straightforward. I mean, engaging evidence is to weigh evidence.
Not exactly. So looking at the evidence and determining that this evidence exists. So if you're looking at the evidence and there is absolutely nothing on the face of the record that suggests that the veteran is either unemployed or does not have it or is marginally employed, then that is just a facial inquiry.
So how does that cohere with the current standard for whether something's reasonably raised? I mean, there's cases, Robinson, Lynch, I mean, there's a whole line of them. And this seems to be a broader articulation of that than those cases.
It is not. I don't believe it is a broader interpretation, because again, going back to the absolutist language that Robinson uses, Robinson says when there is no evidentiary support.
Right, but I mean, if you were to frame it as a negative articulation, then yes, the rule would be something like that. But I think Judge Allen is also struggling to find a limiting principle in what you're saying.
So for us,
since the rules of evidence don't apply, what evaluation is necessary to cause information to constitute evidence? It sounds like your position is if there's any information, what if it's argument?
Well, in that situation, it would still be evidence. If you have, for instance, a statement in support of a claim where the veteran is alleging that the board should consider entitlement to TDIU, then that would be – I'm out of time again, Your Honor. May I continue? In that situation, let's say there's a statement in support of a claim or a letter submitted to the board, an argument submitted to the board, then that's still evidence in this context. The board is still tasked with reviewing that evidence, which means then the court is also tasked with reviewing that evidence. And if the veteran is specifically asking the board to consider something, then we would be in the territory of explicitly raised.
Would it be an adequate remedy if we were to, in cases like this, just give an automatic remand? We're not going to make a finding of administrative error that any time, you know, counsel or anytime a claimant says the board failed to address something and that we'd like them to address it, we could send it back. We could retain jurisdiction. What would that not work practically? Because it seems, I mean, if we just remove the assessment of administrative error, we can send stuff back. We can get the board to address stuff. It seems like we can remedy all of this without having the court, in a sense, to kind of assume the burden of proof of, in almost getting in a kind of adversarial situation with the veteran, we have to sort of prove that the record doesn't reasonably raise something.
As veterans advocates, there would be no issue for us with that outcome, because that would by far be the more veteran-friendly approach and the more veteran-friendly outcome, and maybe even an increase and help and aid some, you know, judicial review, because at the very least you have a more sound and more judicially reviewable decision.
You realize, I mean, obviously this would call into question EJIA for these types of remands, right?
Yes. And so if I may, though, while as veterans advocates, we would have no opposition to that. We don't believe that that has to be the remedy. We do still believe that this court can determine whether an issue is reasonably raised in the first instance. We don't believe that either Tadlock or Stinson constrains this court so much. We're just pushing that in making these determinations, the court cannot go so far as to find facts or weigh the evidence. So here, when we're looking at all of the evidence, we're not concerned with the cause of the unemployability. We're just concerned with whether or not a board adjudicator could look at these symptoms and this decline in employment and say, I think entitlement to TDIU is reasonably raised by this. I'm going to address this. That doesn't get into determining the cause of the unemployability. That does not get into weighing the evidence or picking and choosing which evidence is more persuasive or assigning probative weight to the evidence. It is just sitting back, looking at the entire record and saying some board adjudicator could find there to be a connection here enough to address the issue. And if that, if when you are looking at the evidence, you find that some board adjudicator could find these connected, then that's the answer. The issue is reasonably raised and it has to go back. The court can only find that an issue is not reasonably raised when, after considering the legal context and viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the veteran, there is no evidentiary support and no board adjudicator could determine otherwise.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Pierce. We'll hear from the secretary. Ms. Radke.
May it please the court. The only issue before the court is whether the board clearly erred by not adjudicating TDIU. The court should affirm the board's decision for three reasons. First, under the Federal Circuit's precedent in Stinson and Golden, determining whether something is reasonably raised by the record is not fact-finding, but merely review of the record to determine whether there is sufficient support for an argument. Second, and with the court's permission to clarify the secretary's position, Robinson explains that the board's silence has meaning. And here, that silence must be read as an implicit finding that TDIU was not reasonably raised by the record. And because there is an implicit finding of fact, Tadlock and Stinson are not implicated, and the court is merely reviewing that finding for clear error.
So I want to make sure because this is a change from the secretary's position, which was hard to decipher exactly. But you then, it seems like the parties now changing from their original position, now both are back in agreement that in this case, that the board made an implicit determination that TDIU was not raised by the record because the board said nothing about it.
Yes, Your Honor, we are in agreement that the silence has meaning, and silence here was an implicit finding that TDIU was not raised based on Robinson. However, we disagree that there was an implicit denial.
So then to go to the appellant's point is, or something that Ms. Pierce said early on in her argument, if I have to decide whether the board silence meant that it considered whether TDIU was raised, determined that it was not, but decided I don't need to write anything at all about it because my silence will carry meaning. How am I supposed to review that? It's almost as if a pitcher in baseball, given that we're at the beginning of baseball season, says, I've thought about throwing the ball. I didn't throw the ball, but you umpires should tell me whether the ball I didn't throw because my silence and not throwing it carries meaning. Is it a ball or a strike? And I don't know how as an umpire to Harkin with Chief Justice Roberts, how I would do that. How do I decide whether the board is right or wrong, or clearly right or clearly wrong, when they say nothing at all?
Yes, Your Honor. The court in Robinson expressly addressed this similar issue where silence has meaning. And the court explained that because we presume that the board has reviewed all of the evidence, we must presume it reviewed the evidence and found it too scant to warrant comment. And then the court in Robinson explained that that conclusion, that implied finding, was not clearly erroneous. In a case like this specifically, where the issue is entitlement to TDIU, this court's case law has ingrained in the board that TDIU is something that's part and parcel of an increased rating claim. Further, factors like the board's discussion of the evidence here, the same VA examinations in which appellant asserts reasonably raised the issue of TDIU, the board expressly discussed those examinations. So we're left in the same situation as in Robinson, where the board has explained it's considered the evidence, it's presumed to have considered all of the evidence, and that the court then must assume that it was too scant to warrant comment.
Isn't that going to run into a Hamill problem?
No, Your Honor. We agree with appellant that Hamill does not apply to this case, that Hamill, again, was about the AMA notice requirements for regional office decisions. In addition, it's our...
There aren't notice requirements for the board.
That's correct, Your Honor.
How would that just not kind of run headlong into those?
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that TDIU was not adjudicated. So there could not have been an implicit denial for something that was never adjudicated. And as far as the Secretary is aware, there's no notice requirements to provide veterans of things that had not been adjudicated.
What's the implicit determination that the duty to, or what exactly is, the determination?
The determination would be similar to, like in Miller, where the court held that the board's silence was an implicit finding regarding the veteran's credibility, or in a case like Wallaman, where the court explained that the board's silence on the adequacy of an examination while relying on an examination was an implicit finding that the examination was adequate. Similar in that vein, the silence, Robinson explains that the board is not required to invent and reject all possible theories, all possible arguments in order to provide a valid statement of reasons or bases. So the silence here...
But the Secretary's position doesn't seem to jive with the vision of the board that the Federal Circuit expresses in Robinson, a non-adversarial adjudicator required to consider all issues raised by the claimant, liberally construing their arguments and reasonably raised by the evidence of record. That doesn't sound like, and then with notice requirements at the other end to set forth what arguments they considered and how they resolved them. None of those things happened here.
I disagree, Your Honor. The board considered the issue before it, which was an increased rating for psychiatric disability. It discussed the evidence expressly cited by appellant, in which appellant asserts raised TDIU, and it is aware of this court's case law. It's inconceivable to think that a board judge would not be aware that TDIU would not possibly be part and parcel. So if looking at that, the board did not see any evidence of any argument evidence that TDIU had been reasonably raised, then this court must presume that that was an implied finding, that the evidence did not reasonably raise it, and then it's reviewing that implied finding for clear error. So if...
Why couldn't we just... I mean, this is, maybe not the most judicial way of thinking about this, but, we're arguing about whether or not the board silently did something because, as you say, every member of the board would know that TDIU is part and parcel of an increased rating claim. Why wouldn't we just say, in the context of at least rating a psychiatric disorder, where the rating criteria itself requires the board to consider occupational impairment, And we know that TDIU is part and parcel of any claim for an increased rating. In the context of an increased rating or a rating claim for a psychiatric disorder, the board must explain, at least address TDIU.
Well, Your Honor, the court's case law in Roberson and Comer held that TDIU is only reasonably raised by the record when, in an increased rating claim, the veterans presented cogent evidence of unemployability. And so if there had not been evidence of convincing evidence of unemployability, meaning both not just unemployment, but being possible evidence that the veteran is unable to obtain or maintain substantially gainful employment due to service-connected disabilities, that would not be something that the board would be then required to address until the evidence reaches that point.
Well, except that you're saying that the board implicitly did that, but much like I used to explain to my kids when they were younger, coming up with the right answer to the math problem isn't going to satisfy your teacher because you have to show your work, right? Because that's how they figure out how you got to the end and didn't just guess. Here, how do we evaluate then that the board looked at this, determined that there wasn't cogent evidence of unemployability, despite the fact that we're rating a mental condition that talks about being, in this case, 70% disabling, including occupational impairment. And therefore, lets me say that the board wasn't clearly wrong in whatever the board was thinking in its head when it evaluated this evidence about which it said nothing with respect to cogent evidence of unemployability.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the two big factors here are, again, the court's case law makes clear TDIU is part and parcel. So this is something that the board would be aware of. And the second point for here that the court should be considering is that the board did expressly address the VA examinations that appellant is asserting raised entitlement to TDIU. So those two factors combined would make clear that in cases like this and in circumstances like this, the silence is not just missing something, but silence was an implied finding. Now, there may be circumstances where the silence is missing something. For example, if the board in its reasons or bases when discussing the rating said something expressly along the lines of VA treatment records do not reflect that the veteran is unemployed. And then later on, the appellant points to evidence that, he was unemployed. That would be an indication for this court to realize, no, silence here is a reasons or bases error and not where we can say there was an implicit finding. But in this particular case, when the board expressly discussed this evidence, and given that the issue that they're saying is reasonably raised is TDIU, which there is expansive case law on, it's clear to the secretary that the board's silence here is an implied finding that there were no other theories of entitlement, no other arguments, no other issues reasonably raised by the record. And if the court begins its analysis by looking at whether or not the silence has meaning and silence is an implied finding, then the court need not engage in any concern about impermissible fact-finding and need not engage with Tadlock and Stinson because it's simply reviewing that board finding for clear error. And now if the court...
That rule would revolutionize our work, but this seems a very unlikely case for that to happen in where the board engaged with occupational impairment here, identifying that the veteran had occupational impairment with deficiencies in most areas, such as work, specifically finding he had difficulty in adapting to stressful circumstances, including work or work-like setting, and then talking about impairment in attributes that are generally considered to be important in a workplace and experiencing symptoms that are generally incompatible with the workplace. How does the secretary get around that as reasonably raising the question of TDIU?
First, it's the secretary's contention that the evidence, there's nothing connecting in the record the veteran's unemployment or possibly indicating in the record that the veteran's unemployment was linked to his service-connected disabilities. The statements where he is alleging he is unable to find work for he attributed to his art degree. However, if the court disagrees, if the court is looking at the evidence and is left with the firm and definitive conviction that, yes, this evidence does reasonably raise this issue, then the court should remand for the board to address TDIU in the first instance by holding that the board clearly erred. The court should not do.
What about his statement attributes his unemployment to his art degree? He says, I have an art degree and I can't find work. You can say, I have a law degree and this is the only work I can find.
Well, Your Honor, looking at the face of the evidence, there's nothing in his statements that possibly link his unemployment at times to his service-connected disabilities. Just looking at the four corners, to go beyond that would be interpreting the evidence, which this court cannot do.
But there's a lot of other information, including the board's own findings.
Well, again, Your Honor, if Your Honor, the court disagrees that this evidence is disagrees with the secretary and believes that this evidence is cogent evidence of unemployability, then again, the court should hold that the board was clearly erroneous and remand for the board to adjudicate TDIU, but it should not punt back to the board to make the finding in the first instance. And there's three reasons for that.
So the open to debate language is, if I'm understanding you correctly, it really is no relevance to VA. That's kind of our problem.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court comes in looking at whether or not there is an implied finding, and that's the first step that the court's looking at, then the court will never need to engage in whether something's open to debate. Indeed, if the court could say this matter was open to debate, but if the board's choice of the two is not clearly erroneous, and then the court would then have to affirm. However, again, the court, as the court did in Gardner versus Tran, the court could also just look at the face of the evidence to determine whether, without interpreting the evidence, just on the four corners of the document, if this does raise the evidence. That the Federal Circuit in Stinson, the Federal Circuit in Golden made clear that that is not impermissible fact-finding. It just goes beyond looking at the four corners where the court may be interpreting or weighing evidence that would be impermissible fact-finding. And again, in Gardner versus Tran in footnote 5, the court did expressly address whether or not the board's silence is an implied finding. And the court stated in that footnote, to the extent the silence is an implied finding, such finding would not be clearly erroneous. So this is something that the court has considered. And Gardner, of course, was approximately 6 months prior to Tadlock. But attempting to first, the court looking at whether or not that silence is an implied finding would be the first step. But again, punting back to the board to make the determination in the first instance is not appropriate, and there's three reasons for that. Because first, it would shift the burden from appellant to demonstrate clear error in the decision any time they raise for the first time to this court that something was raised. And it would shift it to VA to say, no, this is the only way to review the evidence is VA's the way VA views it. And that would impermissibly shift the burden. Second, this would then require the court to just rubber stamp remands back to the board and take away the court's review authority.
Question asked your counterpart, which is, what if we just retain jurisdiction, just a remand and board can address? I mean, it seems a pretty simple solution. We can kind of get out of the business of delving into these really tricky factual determinations.
I think that would take away the court's review authority. And just require the court to be rubber stamping remands. And then for the third point for that is that then this would also effectively overturn Robinson, and it would require the board to indent and reject all possible arguments, all possible theories of entitlement, all possible issues that could possibly within the scope of claim in order to produce a valid decision.
Maybe we don't have to make this, you know, the one grand theory of everything in the world, right? Maybe we could approach this very incrementally. We're dealing with a situation in which we have a psychiatric rating, which by its very nature under the Secretary's diagnostic code incorporates occupational impairment levels of severity, and TDIU, which we know deals with employment and is, in fact, raised with respect to every increased rating claim, including one with respect to mental disorders. Okay, we start with that. And in that context, we just say that the board in that context has to give us something to review. Because I'm struggling here as a judge, and I'm thinking, I do defer to the agency as the fact finder. And so maybe the agency could explain to me why, even though it's talking about evidence rating somebody as 70% disabled under a diagnostic code that relates to occupational impairment and has the things that Judge Jakewith has said, nonetheless doesn't show cogent evidence of unemployability. And this is why, right? If the board does that, then I can look at it and I can say, is that clearly wrong? Do I have a definite and firm conviction that an error has been made? But when there's silence, I don't know how I do that in this context. So why couldn't we just say in this context, if the board doesn't say something, doesn't have to use the word TDIU, but something that gets us to there, that's a reasons or bases error, and we're going to remand, even if we don't do it based on agency error, even if we just say, we're not saying you're erred, we're just saying you just didn't give us enough for us to do our job.
Well, Your Honor, I know the psychiatric code expressly states in it occupational and social impairment, and it's rated throughout the various levels of occupational and social impairment. However, all of VA's diagnostic codes, all disabilities, are being rated based on the average impairment of earning capacity. So there's
it's very different. If I do, I agree with you. They're all based on that in theory, right? That's the way it is. But if you're doing the extension of the knee, you don't need to think about employment at all to rate that. You look at the level, you know, the angle, right? And it's 30% extension. And you can award a rating based on 30% limitation of extension without talking about anything else, right? You could see in that context where you'd say, well, yeah, the board doesn't have to say anything, right? But by its nature, that the diagnostic code for mental disorders requires the board to think about what the evidence says about occupational impairment. And so if we start with the assumption that you said that the board member is going to know that TDIU is part of any increased rating claim, and the rating code that they're doing isn't just a background principle of employment issues, it's actually on the face of the code, why wouldn't we say in that context the board has to say something? And if it doesn't say something, either it's error or it's not going to allow us to do the rating of that particular disability.
Again, Your Honor, it's the Secretary's contention that in order for TDIU to be raised, there has to be some evidence, some threshold determination that there's unemployability that may be linked to a service-connected disability. And while there might be occupational impairment in every psychiatric disability rating case, there might not always be possible evidence that links any unemployability with service-connected disabilities. And the court in Bankhead expressly addressed a similar scenario.
Sorry to slow you, but I mean, obviously, the reasonably raised issue applies to issues far beyond TDIU. I mean, it would be extra scheduler consideration, secondary service connection. I mean, there's a whole suite of issues that, you know, how does the sort of implicit denial theory account for those, which is that the board would have conceivably considered all possible other issues and those would all be deemed denied?
Well, first, we aren't arguing that there's an implicit denial, only an implicit finding.
The evidence did not raise any other issues that warranted.
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary's contention that if in looking at every case, depending on what's being argued, the first assumption is that the silence has meaning and that the board is presumed to have reviewed all of the evidence. And there's going to be something in the evidence then that would be obvious then that the board either missed it or that that the board should have expressly addressed something. And again, in this particular case, we believe it's clear because the board did expressly address the evidence that appellant asserts raised the issue. And that, I think, is a factor for every possible argument, theory of entitlement, whether an issue is within a scope of claim, because it's a very broad concept of what might be reasonably raised. And I think that would be something that the court would initially look to. Did the board address this evidence in another context and was silent as to what was being argued? For example, did the board address the veteran's argument in which he asserts symptoms and then now on appeal to the court, the veteran's arguing that though that statement also was asserting that there was a duty to assist error in the examination. Well, if the board had expressly discussed that statement, that would be a factor that the court would be able to look to determine whether the silence should be viewed as an implicit finding that no other argument was raised. And then again, this can be viewed in tandem with the case law, the Federal Circuit's precedent in Golden and in Stinson, where the Federal Circuit expressly stated that this court may appropriately assess whether the record contains sufficient evidence as a matter of law to support a particular argument. And in Golden was just recently issued, which was about whether or not the theory of secondary service connection was reasonably raised. And the Federal Circuit affirmed this court's decision in Golden, holding that this court did not engage in impermissible fact-finding when the court held the board did not err by not adjudicating secondary service connection. And the Federal Circuit explained that the court's analysis in that case merely synthesized, analyzed, and paraphrased the board decision, and it merely acknowledged what the record reflected. And in doing so, that was not impermissible fact-finding. So that is how this court addressed the issue in Gardner versus Tran when addressing whether obesity as an intermediate step for secondary service connection, whether that was reasonably raised. And again,
you're advocating the same test that the appellant's lawyer did, that we're just cataloging evidence and making a reasonably raised determination from that.
Yes, that is the secretary, to the extent that appellant is asserting that the court can do this, can look at the evidence on its face. The secretary, though, asserts that appellant takes it too far and is asking this court to interpret the evidence. And the secretary does agree that context does matter, but that context can't go beyond what the four corners of the document say, and that the court should not be drawing inferences.
Well, when we do that in this case, how do we find that this extensive catalog does not reasonably raise the issue of TDIU?
Your Honor, it's the Secretary's contention that appellant has not demonstrated that what they have pointed to is cogent evidence of unemployability. But again, if the court looks at the same evidence and is left with the clear and definitive conviction that, yes, this is cogent evidence of unemployability, the court should hold that the board clearly erred in not adjudicating it and should not punt back for the board to make any factual findings in the first instance. The secretary agrees with appellant that the court's review authority would not require such. Is there anything further? All right. With that, the secretary urges the court to affirm the board's decision.
Thank you. Appellant's counsel.
Your Honors, silence is still administrative error. The board has a duty to provide an adequate statement of reasons or bases. An appellant must be able to understand the precise basis for the board's decision, and that decision must also facilitate judicial review. To accept the position that the board's silence is enough, because that is a finding, leaves this court with
questions. Exactly why we are here is because of the silence. We cannot reward that silence and say that finding is enough. Additionally, to the point of Golden, we would distinguish from Golden because while it is clear that this court can analyze, paraphrase, and synthesize, here we have no findings for the court to analyze, paraphrase, or synthesize. The board was entirely silent. And then finally, to the extent that the board did address this evidence, it did not address this evidence in the context of unemployability, which is an entirely separate consideration than the rating criteria for mental health.
How would I'm going to ask the same question. So how would your standard work? Let's take it out of the TDIU context. How would it work, for instance, like with secondary service connection or extra scheduler or some other, you know, where there's some evidence in the record that might suggest entitlement, a different basis for entitlement? How would we go about assessing whether the board erred by failing to address this?
I mean, I understand in TDIU, it's obvious, okay, there would be some evidence which says I don't work. Okay, got it. At least maybe that would set things in motion. But how does this work with other contexts where it's a little more hazy?
In that situation, whatever the legal framework is, so if you are looking at whether a claim for secondary service connection is reasonably raised, then you're just looking at the record to determine whether there is some evidence that would suggest a but-for causation between the non-service connected condition and the service connected condition. If there is any kind of evidence that would support that, for instance, if let's talk about obesity because there's been a decent amount of discussion in Garner. If you're looking at a claim and you have a VA medical opinion that says the knee is not warrant direct service connection, it's actually because of the veteran's obesity. But then you go through the record and you see that the veteran is in the MOVE program and you see that the veteran is saying, hey, I can't really exercise because my back hurts so bad. My range of motion is limited because of chronic pain. I have a mental health condition and the medication causes me to binge eat. In that situation, we have the examiner brought obesity into play and now we have the veteran's own statements talking about the impact that his service connection condition causes and that could affect that obesity. Now we have some evidence.
How is that not? I mean, I guess what I'm struggling with, maybe with the court is the open to debate standard is reactive to us, right? And I'm trying to figure out whether the Federal Circuit has articulated a meaningful standard by which we can assess administrative error or whether it's just this is how they'll review our assessments. And you know, I'm searching for a workable standard, and obviously we're struggling. The absence of a finding really does present real difficulties for us. I mean, to weigh evidence, I mean, if we weigh evidence and it's favorable to a claimant, that's not statutorily any different from weighing evidence and non-favorable. It's just weighing evidence. And if we lack the authority as a court to weigh evidence, I don't see how we get around that problem. Because, I mean, no matter how difficult, stringent, or low the standard is, there's going to be some threshold of cases where it's like, oh, you know, I'm with my clerk. Okay, well, did the examiner say this? Maybe if you read that. And then someone's going to object because it's open to debate. I mean, we're going to end up in the same exact place. It's a recursive problem.
If I may, so in terms of the open debate standard, in our supplemental briefing, we defined open to debate as that the answer is not revealed on the face of the record, right? The record itself does not unquestionably reveal the answer. So in that situation, if you are presented with and you do not have an answer and there is a question, then no, you cannot resolve that matter. However, if you are looking at taking it back to the reasonably raised context here, again, because you have to look at the nature of the legal issue, and because when you're talking about reasonably raised, isn't about the merits or even the success on the merits, but it's just about whether
the board should have addressed it and the board should have talked about it, then again, you don't need to interpret the evidence. You just need to determine whether a board adjudicator could have looked at this evidence and found there to be a connection. That you're not saying with certainty that there is a connection. You're also not saying with certainty that there isn't. You're just saying that a board adjudicator out of all of the board adjudicators could look at this and find there to be a connection.
Does there have to be evidence of connectivity in the record?
No, that is not our position. Here, again, we are looking at the larger evidentiary record. And so, again, taking it back to the facts in our case, when you look at the nature of the evidence, when you look at the suicidal ideation and the impaired insight and the difficulty in adapting to stressful circumstances, especially in a work-like setting, and you're taking all of those mental health symptoms, and then you're also looking at the timeline of his employment, and you see that Mr. Williams went from working as a substitute teacher to now he's working 3 hours a day, if at all, and you're seeing that the impact and the severity of the mental health conditions increased at the same time that the employment decreased, then you can look at that and you can say a board adjudicator could determine that these two are connected and therefore entitlement to TDIU is reasonably raised.
Both counsel have talked about the fact that, you know, it's just Golden talks about looking at the evidence but not interpreting it. I have to say, and this is not a criticism to counsel, I quite literally have absolutely no idea what that means. I don't know how I as a judge can look at something to make a determination about its legal impact where I'm not interpreting the evidence, right? I'm not sure that's a meaningful distinction.
So our position is that Golden does not reach so far. Our position is that Golden was actually pretty limited. In Golden, what the court did was they just said, the board was correct. Okay, there is no examination that addressed the connection between tinnitus and hearing loss. That is a facial inquiry, and that is saying exactly what is on the face of the record. So to your point, the difference would be saying this statement exists. What the secretary is asking is for you to look at that statement and not just say that it exists, but say he is attributing the cause of his unemployability to his art degree. And that is the only way that you can look at this statement. And by saying it that way, that's not an interpretation, but it is. By reading that statement and saying that Mr. Williams, a pro se veteran who experiences defensiveness and hostility when posed with occupational questioning, is the sole source to be considered when determining the cause of unemployability, you are making findings of competency, you are making findings of credibility, and you are assigning probative weight because you're also then looking at the cause of that unemployability, not just whether there is evidence of unemployability.
But is that not true? Let's narrow Mr. Williams' circumstances down to just these. He has a disability that is depression. He has an art degree, and he's not employed. Does that raise TDIU? He might be depressed because he's unemployed or because he's decided he doesn't like art.
Well, exactly. That's the point. He might be unemployed because he's depressed, or he might be unemployed because of his art degree. But that determination is not one for this court to make. So in that situation, if this court found that was sufficient to raise the issue of TDIU, then it would absolutely have to go back.
Well, but wouldn't we, under your theory on Judge Jaquith's hypothetical of the facts, it would always potentially raise this, because I mean, I couldn't say that a board member would be wrong, or clearly wrong, if they read the statement to ascribe it to a pro-claimant approach to this, right? That his depression is causing this problem. But I equally think somebody wouldn't be wrong to read that statement under Judge Jaquith's hypothetical to mean the opposite, right? So
again,
our role seems to be like nothing there.
But I think that's the nature of the reasonably raised inquiry. And I see I'm almost out of time, so if I may just finish answering the question and then conclude. That's exactly the nature of the reasonably raised inquiry. The Robinson uses the absolutist language in
regards to the no evidentiary support, because if you're looking at this and there are multiple different reasonable interpretations, then that means that there is, in essence, some evidence, because at least one board adjudicator could look at that and find a connection. And that is enough to warrant entitlement to TDIU being reasonably raised. Because Mr. Williams experiences suicidal ideation, impaired insight, and occupational impairment with deficiencies in most areas such as work, and because Mr. Williams was seeking the increased rating, entitlement to TDIU was reasonably raised. Mr. Williams respectfully requests the court vacate and remand the board's decision with instruction for the board to address TDIU on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I gavel us out, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen next, as I understand it, and the clerk or the chief judge can tell me if that's wrong. And that is, our custom is to greet the advocates when we finish. So we'll do that. We'll come back up here and we'll take your questions, not having to do with the outcome of this case, but any other questions you might have. Okay. Case is submitted.
All right.